This is a CBC podcast.
Hi, I'm Pia Chattopadhyay. Welcome to the Sunday Magazine podcast, featuring the stories we first brought you Sunday, September 8th on CBC Radio. It's a new political landscape in Ottawa. The Liberal NDP deal is dead. So what lies ahead for MPs as they return to Parliament? Our Sunday Politics panel takes on this new chapter first up. After that, we'll turn the page and hear why the humble notebook still endures in our digital age. And then, with less than 2 months to go until the U.S. election, I'll be speaking with a guy whose name is synonymous with polling. Nate Silver will add up where the candidates stand and what role risk plays in who holds power, political or otherwise. And later on, our monthly challenge, That's Puzzling, it's back. The odds may be against me, though, because I'll be facing off against Canada's top Jeopardy champ, and my new CBC colleague, Matea Roach. It all starts right now on the Sunday Magazine. It was a landmark week in Canadian politics. NDP leader Jagmeet Singh ended his party's supply and confidence agreement with the Liberals, a deal that for the past 2.5 years had propped up the Liberals' minority government. But the move has implications that go beyond these two parties as Parliament gets set to resume and Quebec and Manitoba prepare for a series of important by-elections. So we have convened our Sunday Politics panel. Susan Delacourt is a national columnist for the Toronto Star, and Matt Gurney is the co-founder of The Line on Substack. Susan and Matt, good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
Let us start with this deal. Matt, you believe it was a huge mistake for the NDP to enter this agreement in the first place. So now that it's ended, what's on your mind?
I think it was a mistake for them to enter the agreement and act the way they did. I think there was a way for them to have an agreement like this, and there were other ways for them to have agreements like this. And I wouldn't have necessarily been opposed to them. But I don't think Mr. Singh ever figured out a way to stick the balance of being half pregnant on this one, like insisting he was going to remain an effective independent opposition leader who had happened to sign a written agreement pledging himself to not bring down the government for a set period of time. It never made sense to me, and Mr. Singh never really figured out a way to explain that, at least to my satisfaction. So what happens next? I think at the very least, we might see a more effective Mr. Singh, at least a more unburdened one. He's now able to actually do what he's been trying to do for 2.5 years, and he won't sound kind of ridiculous when he does it. But in terms of, I think, the bigger picture, and I know Susan and I are going to get into it, Pia, is how is this all going to shake out? I think probably on a personal level, Mr. Singh benefits the most from this because he can kind of actually, you know, speak more freely, to put it as simply as that. But I also think it puts his party in probably the trickiest position here. The Liberals and the Conservatives are both going to try and squeeze him.
Okay, Susan. So Matt sort of set the table there for us to talk about winners and losers. And he suggests that the NDP is a winner by this deal being ripped up, as Jagmeet Singh said he had done to it, although there's actually no paper agreement. Talk about who you think is going to benefit the most, or perhaps not the most, but still benefit from the end of this deal.
Well, clearly the Conservatives benefit from this. They want an election yesterday. I think Pierre Poilievre was in for a tougher fall, because as the nearer we loom to the next election, the scrutiny on him will be heavier. So I think with this, he gets a chance to press Singh at every opportunity to bring down the government. You know, he's already started that. So that's what I'm looking forward to this fall is, and I think when things get that emotional and intense, accidents can happen too. Mm-hmm. So I'm braced for the idea that we may get an election sooner than we expected. And if we do, that's good news for the Conservatives.
Let me ask you this. Since the announcement that the deal was over, Pierre Poilievre, he's been talking about axe the tax, the carbon tax. But he in the last few days, has been saying, look, bring down this government, Jagmeet Singh, on the carbon tax. Is that even possible?
Yes. Yeah, it definitely is possible. Although I'm not sure the Bloc would go along with the idea of an election over that. And, we haven't had to pay attention to the Bloc much because of this deal. But the Bloc is very, what's the word I'm looking for? I don't want to say hostile, but they certainly don't like Poilievre and they don't like the politics of the Conservatives. And I think we're going to see that tension ratchet up this fall as well.
You've talked in the past, Susan, about the sort of tone and tenor of debate in the House, even outside the House. So given what you've just said, what do you expecting?
It's going to be bad. It's, we've had a little break from it this summer, but it's going to be bad.
All right. We've talked about the NDP a bit, and as well as the Quebec, Bloc Québécois and the Conservatives. Let's talk about the government. The Liberals are already behind in the polls. They have been for some time now. Just after the deal between the NDP and Liberals came to an end, the National Campaign Director for the Liberals, Jeremy Broadhurst, stepped down for what he cited as family reasons. So I want to speak with both of you about this for a bit. Matt, what do the Liberals need to do to turn around their flailing political fortunes now?
You know, honestly, my answer is that they can't. Like, I can give them advice about, like, things to do that would make their lives easier or make them a little more dignified. But I've talked with Susan about this before, so I'm not revealing anything for the first time. I think the Liberals probably need to start thinking more from the perspective of not whether or not they're going to lose, but how they want to lose. And I mean, kind of like, how much furniture do they want to save, whether or not they want to do a leadership review before or after. Obviously, there's always things that you can do. And the one thing I cannot discount, the one doubt in my mind, is just all the wild events we've had in recent years and how God only knows what's going to happen today, tomorrow, 6 months from now, 12 months from now. That could totally upend things. I get that and I acknowledge that. But barring any large event like that, I just think that, and this is something Susan and I were just talking about a few days ago, even if there is a real souring on Mr. Trudeau, on Mr. Poilievre, even if, as I think some Liberals are hoping, even if there's sort of like a progressive revival in the United States and Kamala Harris is elected president, you need a vessel that could be sort of directed into if you're Canadian Liberals. I just think the PM by this point is too unpopular, too polarizing, and I think too tired. Maybe with a fresh leader before or after the election, they could, but I'm not even convinced at this point they could do that. So my advice to them, and on the off chance that they're listening, is that they start thinking about more how they want to lose than how they want to win.
What do you mean by that? How they want to lose?
There's a big difference if you're the Liberals and you lose, but you have 80 seats and you lose and you have 40. And I think they should at this point be thinking more about what they want to, what position they want themselves and the party to be in terms of seat count, in terms of fundraising ability, in terms of staff, in terms of, frankly, reputation and legacy, and also just like good old fashioned money ahead of the election. I do know that some of them are thinking about this already. I know that the reason the prime minister is under pressure is because some people think that there might be a chance to do some kind of Biden-Harris-esque switcheroo with a new leader who might actually perform better in the next election, even if they don't win. I've never been sold on that. I actually think Justin Trudeau might be the guy to lead them into the next election. But I just think, I don't know, one of the things that can happen to governments when they're down in the polls like this is they start doing increasingly weird and desperate stuff that doesn't work and just leaves everybody embarrassed in the aftermath.
Okay, Susan, what Matt said there about, maybe there isn't a path back, you're kind of hearing that from a lot of Liberals and certainly a lot of pundits just saying like there is no path back. Do you think there is a path back here for the Liberals?
Well, I know Matt and I disagree on this a little bit. Pardon me. I don't want to overstate it, But I think what's going on in the United States right now is how might possibly have a ripple effect here, not a progressive revival, but a souring of the kind of politics that Donald Trump does. And Pierre Polyev does not like the comparison, but he keeps inviting it, including nicknaming his rivals. I think we're going to see a real exhaustion with the negative kind of politics south of the border and here. And I don't know that Pierre Polyev can carry a hope and change kind of message. He seems more on tuned on negative all the time. So will Canadians sour on the Conservatives to the extent that they seem to be liking them now? Although I would say that I don't think there's a Pierre Polyev mania out there. I think he's benefiting from what Matt correctly describes as the exhaustion with Trudeau. But I do think that what's happening in the United States may make Canadians look at their own politics a little bit differently.
So we're already seeing kind of the echoes of the narrative from the U.S. kind of echoing here. So like, if we just look at the NDP, Jagmeet Singh is now declaring the NDP the party of hope. So echoes of the Democrats in the United States, and Pierre Polyev, Jagmeet Singh says the Conservatives are the party of cuts and coldness. In a way, that sort of hope change reminds us so much of Sunny Ways of the Liberals. So what are there actual parallels between the U.S. and the Canada, Matt, as you see them, in terms of sort of narratives?
Yeah. And well, you know, it's a great question. And first answer is, yeah, there's always narratives. Like a lot of the things that are driving this, some of the economic issues in Canada and the United States, largely similar here. And I know people yell at me and point at charts showing lines going in different directions, but I'm just talking to your point in the narrative sense. Like it's hard to afford groceries. It's hard to afford housing. It's hard to find a job in some areas, or at least for some people. So some of those narratives are the same. But I do think the reason, and this, I think this might honestly be where Susan and I disagree on this issue. I don't think Canadians are yet as polarized as Americans. And that's why I think if there is going to be some turnaround in Canada, and I agree with her that we will sour on kind of the negative politics eventually. But in order for it to be relevant to Mr. Trudeau, we have to sour on it in the next 6 to 12 months. And that I don't think is going to happen, because I just don't think we're as far along the path. The Americans are in a weirder, darker, existential, if the other guys win, everything is lost phase. You hear some Canadian partisans talk that way, but I just don't think the broader population feels that way yet.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with journalists Susan Delacorte and Matt Gurney. They're here discussing what else but Canadian politics, as they always do. Thank you for doing it, my friends. Susan, you know, the Liberals are heading to BC. There is a Liberal caucus retreat, I think, begins early this week. The mood, I can imagine, is somewhat despondent and somewhat panicked. Is that a fair characterization?
All of the above, yes.
Yeah.
I think, you know, people are on various scales of it. But that, you know, there'd be desperation, anger. What's the new movie out about all those emotions? The only one there isn't there
the
is
the Pixar movie. Yes.
That's
yes.
It. Yeah. There's no joy. I don't think anybody's walking in feeling joyous to Nanaimo.
And walking in is Mark Carney, right? Former Bank of Canada governor, invited there by the PMO to advise on economic productivity plan for the Liberals. But I mean, he's often in the mix when there's talk of replacing Justin Trudeau as Liberal leader.
I regard a lot of that talk as overstated. I think it comes from people who really want another Paul Martin, Jean Chrétien kind of tension in the Liberal Party. Having written a book about that, I don't want to see that again. It was a bit of a mess. But it was exciting. But I don't think the Liberal Party is polarized, to use Matt's term, between Mark Carney and Justin Trudeau in the way that some people think. It's going to be interesting to see him in the room. I think it's a provocative act by the PMO to put that storyline to rest, that Mark Carney is agitating to oust Justin Trudeau. I just don't think that's happening. I may be naive, but I just don't see that happening.
You, Susan, have covered Justin Trudeau for many, many years. You have interviewed him. You know him a little, you know, in terms of how he thinks, as best as a journalist can get into the mind of someone else. What do you think he's thinking right now?
I think he's still thinking of leaving. I don't think that he's ruled that out entirely. I think he's pretty consumed, as are a lot of people around him, with the events in the States. He may be waiting to see which president he's going to be dealing with and then make his decisions from there. But I think I've said this on the show before. I actually said to him in the spring at an event, I said, I'm not convinced you're staying. And he said, good, I'm glad I'm keeping you wondering. Which is a very Pierre Trudeau kind of thing to say, frankly. So I don't think he's ruled anything out, and I know he'd be listening. What I have not seen yet are caucus members willing to walk up to him and say, you should go. If that happens in Nanaimo, I'll be surprised, because they haven't done it yet. But except for Wayne Long. But I think he's keeping all his options open.
Would the message be the same if some caucus members and cabinet ministers, instead of saying, hey, we want you to go, it's just like, we're going to go. If you're going to stay, we're out of there. Isn't that kind of a similar message that you're sending to your leader?
Oh, this is somebody raised this week in the swirl of, now that an election is closer, or the possibility of an election is closer, we may see a little stampede out the door. You know, a lot of Liberal MPs thought they had until next fall or maybe the spring to decide whether they were staying on. So we may see in Nanaimo some more people saying, you know what, if I'm going to lose, I'm out of here. And that goes to what Matt was talking about, too, is, you know, are we going to be down to 80 or 40 or 20 or 2, as we saw in 1993? So I think there are more Liberals today taking a hard look at their future than there were a week ago.
Okay, Matt. So Susan said, yeah, go ahead. Just go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to jump in there just with two quick comments, Pia, and then I'll let you take your show back. But I mean, the first thing is that if we take the long view over the last 6 months, I mean, there is already evidence that some Liberals are pulling the plug and leaving. That's the reason why we have some of these by-elections. That's the reason why we're talking about Mr. Broadhurst leaving the PMO this week. I agree to use Susan's word. It's not a stampede yet, and she's right about that. But it's not happening. So we should probably bear that in mind. The other point I just wanted to make on the issue of will he stay or will he go, something I was writing about recently was that the Liberals don't have a lot of 9-week solid blocks of summer idleness left. Like, if there is going to be a prime ministerial withdrawal, if there's going to be any kind of leadership race, there really isn't actually that much time left to do it. And they can kludge it. They can come up with some kind of structure to fit any scenario that they face here. But if they were going to do it, they should have done it 3 months ago. Like, they should have used the summer. They are not guaranteed another summer, especially after the events of last week. Is it possible for them to do it? Yeah. But I think in a practical sense, if they haven't yet passed the point of no return on that one, they're pretty close to it.
You answered the question I was going to ask, so thank you for doing that. We have these by-elections a week tomorrow, I think September 16th, that are happening in Manitoba and Quebec. We always talk about by-elections being a, you know, some kind of bellwether. Is it signaling something or not? So, Susan, let me come to you first on these by-elections. How critical are they in terms of what message they may send to whatever party, depending who wins and loses?
Oh, really important. And there's a very good chance the Liberals might lose both of them. La Salle-Aymar Verdun, where David Lametti held his seat, the NDP is hearing good things at the door there. They have a strong local candidate, and it sounds like things are going okay for the NDP there. They have a fight with the Conservatives in Elmwood Transcona in Manitoba. So that will be indicative of where the fortunes of those two parties lie. I don't think the Liberals stand a chance. But I think for the Liberals, for morale reasons, I'll be watching turnout. Liberals lose elections when their voters don't vote. And what I'm hearing right now is they're dealing with a lot of people saying, look, I'm not going to vote for Poilievre, but I'm not going to vote for you either.
You said that, you know, you think that Justin Trudeau is still in the consideration mode of if he should stay or go. If they lose the Montreal by-election, I imagine you might say that's one more thing in the go column for him.
Oh, for sure. I would think, yes. In his own home riding,
home province,
he thinks of himself as he's a proud Quebecer. And to lose in Quebec would be a blow, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Matt, how are you assessing these upcoming by-elections?
You know, I don't think I have anything to say that disagrees with Susan. I'm not hearing a ton about the Manitoba one. It's not where I have the greatest sources, but everything I've heard completely aligns with what she said. On the Montreal front, everything I'm hearing is that the Liberals are preparing not only to lose it, but for all the chaos that could unleash in their own caucus. We all remember how weird things got after St. Paul's, and the Liberals were very, very lucky that they were right up against the summer, and they were able to get everybody home and ride that one out. If they lose the Montreal by-election, they're going to be in a very similar situation, and they're not going to have 9 weeks of summer to fall back on.
Okay, we're going to leave it there. I know we talked a lot about the politics and not policy and stuff, but that seems to be what this season of politics, at least as Parliament resumes, is going to be about. Thank you both, as always. We'll talk to you again soon.
Thanks, guys. Thanks.
Susan Delacourt is a national columnist for the Toronto Star, and Matt Gurney is the co-founder of The Line on Substack and a columnist for TVO. I'm Pia Chattopadhyay. This is the Sunday Magazine on CBC Radio. And on your mobile phone, wherever you are, via the CBC News app, you can simply download the app for free and use the local tab to stream us live. And jot down our email address, will ya? It's sunday@cbc.ca. Speaking of jotting things down, lined, coiled, hardcover, soft, however you like them, the start of a new school year often means a fresh notebook, or 10 perhaps. And it turns out how we scribble and scribe can reveal much about how we think and who we are. Roland Allen is a writer and book publisher. He has pored over centuries of notebook records to discover how these scraps have turned the page on innovation and creativity and still endure today, even in the age of the tablet. His new book is called The Notebook, A History of Thinking on Paper. Roland, good morning to you.
Good morning. Nice to speak to you, Pia.
Yeah, nice to have you here. Not to get too intimate right from the jump, but what's the last thing you scribbled down in your notebook?
I've got a lot on at the moment because I'm promoting the book. So I had a session sticking down all of the meetings and appearances and things I've got coming up in my diary, and it reduced my anxiety considerably, taking them out of emails and putting them down on paper.
I was out school shopping for my kids the other day, looking for notebooks. They said, we got to go find notebooks, Mom. And I said, okay, cool. Let's go to the notebook section. You just use the word diary. When I go to the notebook section, there are diaries, there are journals, there are planners, there are notebooks, there are all kinds of things. So just to clarify for us, when we're saying notebook, what are we talking about?
I make it a very broad definition, I think. Basically, it's got to be paper. And it's got to be lots and lots of blank pages. But within that, I include diaries and all kinds of working notebooks and business ledgers and things like that. Could be large, could be small.
Okay. You're on the same page as many of these students right now, as you said. You've got a busy notebook. But you've been thinking about notebooks for a long time now. You're a book publisher. You're in love with the pen and paper. I understand that, the pen and the page. But why did you want to dig into the origin story of notebooks?
It just came out of a really idle query. I had time on my hands. I'd been made redundant about 5 years ago, so I wasn't working temporarily. And one day I just asked myself, oh, where did this thing come from? And I looked it up and couldn't really find an answer. And it just became one of those things that became more and more of an obsession over time as I was sort of Googling away and hunting around. And it turned out that, you know, the answer wasn't what I'd suspected at all. But also it turned out that people just didn't seem to know. So I thought, this is something, this is interesting. And then the more I looked into it, the more I realized that there was lots of stories there and ample material for a book.
Yeah, isn't that just the best? Those everyday items that we, when you stop yourself, say, hey, how did this even all start? And then you go down that rabbit hole to figure it out.
So exactly.
Thank you for helping us all figure it out. What do we know about the world's first notebooks?
Well, the world's first paper notebooks were probably in somewhere like Baghdad, and probably in around the year 800. But unfortunately, Baghdad since that time has been destroyed and rebuilt a number of times by Genghis Khan, amongst others. So the records we have from that time are pretty sparse, and not many notebooks, or none that I could find, have survived from that era. Eventually, they make it to Europe, and it's from Italy around the year 1250, 1300 that they really start to survive in large numbers, and that's when they start to have this huge impact on European culture and civilization and economies as well. So that's sort of where the main story starts.
What are people in Europe using notebooks for originally?
The main purpose is to run their businesses. So think of the notebook as the kind of computer of its day. The first application of the computer was IT, literally managing what you bought and sold if you were an Italian merchant. And Italian merchants were sort of Europe's leading traders at the time. They were in charge of business across Europe pretty much, and banking. So they're using notebooks and business ledgers to manage double entry bookkeeping, for instance, which they invent, or companies, or limited liability partnerships, or future trading, things like that. But then, of course, they start taking them home and using notebooks for other things. So you have personal notebooks that they keep at home for all kinds of reasons.
Tell me some of those reasons. Well, tell me about the transition from sort of the business world and using notebooks into how people use them more personally.
So what's really interesting is that they don't keep diaries as we think of them, but they do keep kind of family record books where they'll have a formal record of births, marriages, deaths, baptisms, big events like that, and also when they start up their own businesses. They'll keep records of their tax returns, particularly in towns like Florence, which are very regulated. But the most fun kind of notebooks are Zibaldoni, which are... they're similar to the notebooks that many of us keep when we're getting into things like poetry or songs. You just write down things which interest you. You write down poems you've heard that you want to recall later on, or you write down Aesop's fables, or you write down stories from the Bible or prayers that you particularly want to remember. Anything that you really enjoy and you want to keep goes into your Zibaldoni if you're a Florentine in the 1300s.
So I think of that as a journal, not how people journal today, but as the actual book, a journal, like where you just keep, as you say, heard a song, want to write it down, read something, write it down in this book. So this is a collection, like they're the best to go back through over the years. You're like, I remember when I was looking that up. So as these Zibaldonis come in to broader use, how did it change then at the time how things like literature was shared, how it was consumed?
Well, it made it much more accessible because... before that, literature was, a lot of it was oral. You had people, we'd call them minstrels maybe, who would just know a lot of poems or songs off by heart and would reel them out in public places and people would enjoy them. But very few people actually had complete books at the time. So in the home, this was before printing. So if you're talking about books, you're talking about manuscript copies, which are really expensive, difficult to get hold of, very, very high status items. But a Zibaldoni was cheap. You could keep it yourself, and that meant that if your neighbours had the latest poem by Dante or someone like that, you could just copy it off them, and then it was in your house, and then you could share it with your family, you could read it together, you could pass the book down to your children when you died. And I don't think it's a coincidence. You see in Florence at this time a real flowering of literature, and I do think it's because the audience is growing for people like Dante or Boccaccio or Petrarch, who are sort of the founders, if you like, of modern Italian literature.
And so the Zibaldoni, that's how things sort of changed for readers. But for writers, notebooks have always been an essential tool. And when people probe their personal notes in their notebooks, they usually reveal a lot about how their minds worked, what they were thinking at the time. And so in your book, Roland, you profile several famous figures, including Agatha Christie and Virginia Woolf. What do their notebooks tell us about their kind of creative and intellectual processes? Like, when were you like, wow, that's amazing?
I mean, it's fantastic. It really brings them to life. You get a sense for the writer and their lifestyle behind the writing. So Virginia Woolf, for instance, she was an incredibly busy writer. She was more or less always writing a novel. She had her own publishing house as well. She wrote review after review for the Times Literary Supplement. So she was an incredibly busy, productive person. And for every project she had on the go, she had a separate notebook, very, very well organized, very rigorous. If she was writing a book review, she would take notes about the book in one notebook, then she would switch over to something else, then she would write her personal diary in yet another notebook, all very neat and tidy, very well organized. Whereas Agatha Christie, for instance, who wrote, she was also very busy. She wrote a book every year, plus short stories and plays and all kinds of other things. She was absolutely chaotic. She seems to have kept one school exercise book on the kitchen table, another one down the back of the sofa, another in her handbag, another upstairs, another in the garden, wherever. And as soon as she had an idea, she would just jot it down at random in these books. So they're completely chaotic. There are about 80 of them that have survived, I think. And they're just full of random dots and dashes and questions. She's always talking to herself, what if this happened? Or what if he did that? Or what if she was the killer? Would that work? And it's possible to actually reconstruct the plots of about 50 or 60 of her novels from these crazy, disorganized notebooks. But how she did it is miraculous.
And Roland, beyond literature, you also explore the ways notebooks change other realms of the art world. So tell me about that.
Yeah, going back to Florence again. So the year 1300, you're not just looking at literature and the economy changing, you're also looking at painting changing, because this is when we go from the very old-fashioned traditional styles of European painting where, for instance, people don't really look like people. If someone's wearing a crown and they have a beard, they're the king. That's how you know. If someone's wearing a bishop's hat, then they're a bishop. That sort of almost cartoony art is suddenly superseded at very, very quickly by people who can draw a portrait and it looks like the person they're drawing. And so, for instance, we know what we don't know what any popes looked like before the year 1300, but I think after the year 1300, we know what they all looked like. We have a good portrait of every pope. So that changed really quickly. And I think it was because people had sketchbooks for the first time. Young artists could practice with a stylus or with pen and ink or with a bit of charcoal or chalk, drawing. And drawing a lot is how you get good at painting, and painting realistically in particular. And that comes on very, very quickly with Giotto, the painter in particular. So then you have the origins of the Florentine Renaissance and all of the painters who followed, like, for instance, Leonardo, who was told people to always keep a sketchbook at hand and never stop drawing.
There's an analogy you make that I want you to tell us about, and that is the sort of emerging use of notebooks across Europe to that of the modern computer. So tell us the analogy you're drawing there.
Yeah, this occurred to me quite late on, actually. But if you look at when computers arrived, the sort of the first, well, IBM, for instance, the first computers, IBM stands for International Business Machines. They were intended for businesses. So they were bookkeeping tools, and they were for managing money and products and manufacturing and so on. And that's exactly the same with the first notebooks we see in Europe. They're business tools. And then IBM gets sort of superseded by Microsoft, and the computer comes into the home, and then by Apple, and then the computer becomes this amazing creative tool. And it's a very similar process with notebooks. You see them become domestic items, and then you see them become artistic and cultural items, and then, you know, the sky's the limit. And you can't, in ways which I think were quite unpredictable to the early inventors of the computer, they wouldn't have predicted Pixar, for instance, I don't think.
If you're just joining us on this Sunday morning, I'm Pia Chattopadhyay, and I'm speaking with writer and publisher Roland Allen all about the history and enduring power of the notebook, because Roland has a new book about them. So, Roland, you know, we've been talking about notebooks being used for introspection or professional reasons, artistic reasons, but you say that notebooks are also social, and this all dates back to Northern Europe in the 1600s and something called a friendship book.
Yeah, the friendship book, or the album amicorum, the album of friends. And this is an example of a sort of weird trend which just takes off and no one really knows why, and then it goes away again. And it reaches its peak in the Netherlands, in Holland, in the sort of 1600s, 1700s. And students in particular would carry these little friendship albums around with them. And when they had a new professor, or when they met someone interesting, or when they went into class and made a new friend, they would write in each other's friendship books, put a little dedication on a page. You would give a page to your new friend, They would put a little motto on it, or perhaps a sketch or a drawing or a few lines of poetry or a Latin tag, and then they would sign it. I'm your friend for life now. And then you would carry around this little friendship book with you. And of course, you could then use it for introductions to other people. So if Professor So-and-so had signed it, then you could go off to the next university and say, well, you know, Professor So-and-so likes me, so can I join your class? And in that sense, it was very like LinkedIn is today. You could get recommendations from it. You could turn your informal network of friends and acquaintances into something tangible, which you could sort of cash in on. And they're really beautiful as well, because obviously they get slightly competitive about how good a drawing they can put in it. And this is a real golden age of Dutch art. So a lot of people can draw really well. So they're beautiful, and thousands of them have survived.
I love this. This is like original, you know, OG social media.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Oh, wow. Let's bring these things back. I love this idea of people toting them around and showing them other friends with so-and-so and what they've art or poem they've written for them. And we know, Roland, that notebooks still play so many, play such an important role in so many realms of our life. And, you know, if you think about going to a hospital setting, there are still patient diaries, for example. So I'm interested in that because here we have a high-tech, complex medical world. And then we have this very simple thing, pen and paper that is bound into this notebook. Why is something as simple and analog as a notebook important?
Well, you can answer this on multiple levels. On a psychological level, it's really important, I think, because the patient... So you get a patient diary. When you go into the ICU and you're put into a coma, you lose time. So if you might just have been in a car crash, for instance, or you may have had a kidney transplant or whatever it is, but you're put into a coma because your body needs to be in shutdown for you to survive. And you lose that time. So you wake up a week later, or sometimes if you've had a serious COVID, for instance, it could be a month or 6 weeks later, and that time is just gone. And you've probably been having crazy anesthetic dreams during that period, and delusions as well. A lot of people have hallucinations. So you wake up in a very, very disturbed state. And they've worked out, they've discovered that if the nurses and doctors and visitors and the people who care for you while you're knocked out, if they keep a diary saying, Tuesday, we gave you a bed bath, we gave you these medicines, you didn't move, but we think you might have been listening, etc., etc. When you come out of it, you can have some kind of anchor. You have some kind of rock in the bog, someone told me who'd had this happen to him. And it gives you back that lost time. And it really, really reduces the trauma of intensive care, which is, and I didn't know this before I wrote the book, intensive care itself is incredibly traumatic to people, quite regardless of the illness or the injury which has got you in there. So patient diaries are a really simple solution to that. So psychologically, they just give you that time back. And you then have it as a kind of physical object, as a kind of real thing you can pick up and touch, so that you know it wasn't all a really mad dream, and you know that people were really caring for you. Now, on a philosophical level, I think, personally, that when you write something down like that, when you write a diary, you're putting a bit of your soul on the page. So what you hear is that these nurses, they're doing what nurses always do, but because they're writing down, we cared for you in this way, we showed you this amount of, not affection, but we showed you this amount of respect, and we really looked after you. We put our heart and soul into looking after you and making you get better. That, on a sort of philosophical level, is a really loving gesture, and I think people really react to that.
You know, as people have headed back to school, I think a lot of families are like busy cleaning their houses. I know I was like, oh, do you need this notebook? And you find another notebook. I love that. I love going back and seeing what someone's handwriting looked like or what they were writing about. It's all nostalgic. I love the tactile nature of a notebook. However, Roland, there is someone listening who is saying, I don't really need notebooks anymore. I got my computer. I got my device, you know, funnily enough, they're sometimes called tablets and notebooks for
and
that
notebooks,
matter.
Yeah.
So what's the case in 2024 for pen and paper? Why should or why do old school notebooks endure?
There are a lot of reasons. I think a really important thing is that you're making a physical object, which is unique. So In the same way as a potter with a wheel is making a vase or a mug which has imperfections, which is a bit wonky, which isn't quite perfect, but they've made it and it has a little bit of them in it. When you write a notebook, when you fill it up with your own thoughts or your ideas or your feelings or even just your own shopping lists, it's unique. There's nothing else, and it's a very honest reflection of what you are. In a way which your computer files, I don't think, have that kind of resonance, because they're not really physical things. You can't touch them. They don't have sensory properties. I think that's important. Another really important thing education is that if you can write in a notebook, and I'm becoming aware that a lot of people have to type for medical reasons. For instance, if you've got rheumatic fingers or whatever, but if you can write in a notebook, you learn much better than if you're typing. So if you're in a lecture listening to someone tell you about medieval poetry or brain surgery or any of these things, if you're writing down your notes, you're much more likely to remember them and to understand the content of the lecture than if you're typing. Because if you're typing, you normally just bash down what the person says without interacting with it, without understanding it. So there are a couple of reasons there where I think written notebooks are better in general in education, and I think people are coming around to this. But as I say, you know, there are some people for whom the typewriter or the laptop is a much better option, and that's the way it is. But I think if you've got a choice, if you're lucky enough to have the choice, then you should definitely write things down.
A love letter to a notebook, huh?
Exactly. Yeah, I hope so.
Thanks, Roland. It's been great to talk to you. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Roland Allen is the author of The Notebook, A History of Thinking on Paper. There is a saying in poker that goes something like, "The only sure thing about luck is that it will change." Of course, that motto can apply to more than just a game of Texas Hold'em or blackjack. And in the turbulent world of American politics, fortunes can shift pretty quickly. From an assassination attempt against one candidate to the meme-fueled rise of another, predicting who will be lucky enough to win the current presidential election has become somewhat difficult for pollsters. But Nate Silver believes there's another aspect of poker that is even more important to political fortunes than luck. The American statistician, political blogger, former professional poker player, and founder of the polling aggregator 538 says that risks and people's willingness to take them could determine who wins in November. Nate's new book is called On the Edge, The Art of Risking Everything. Nate Silver, good morning.
Good morning, Pia.
Nice to have you with us, my friend. Let us start with the current snapshot of American politics. So 1 week after Labor Day, which is about where we're at, is when the presidential race typically heats up. How are each of the candidates performing?
So we saw, as you mentioned in the intro, Kamala Harris had a lot of momentum coming out of her replacement of Biden. She consolidated support among the Democrats very quickly. But now there perhaps has been a turn in the polls. The New York Times had a poll out this morning. They're a very reliable pollster that had Trump up by 1 point nationally. The polling average probably still has Harris up by maybe 2 points nationally. However, in the U.S., of course, we have the Electoral College, and there it's more challenging for her. Typically, the Electoral College is more Republican than the popular vote is. And so if you had an election today, it would be very close, perhaps an edge toward Trump. It might look a little bit like 2016 when we had that Electoral College popular vote split. But there are two more months. It's a very close race. And the debate coming up this week will be probably more important than what the polls say this morning.
Yeah, your poll tracker has Harris leading Trump by more than 3 percentage points nationally. But as you say, in the United States, the Electoral College is everything, frankly. On Friday, it was interesting, Donald Trump out on the hustings mentioned you in a press conference. Yeah. Here we go.
And he's having a heart attack because I'm leading in the polls, I guess. If you look at the Nate Silver, very respected guy. I don't know him, but he has me up by a lot. So let's say we're leading, or let's say we're tied, or let's say, what difference? I'm in the race. It's between two people, but I think we're leading by a lot.
So, very respected guy. What did you make of what Donald Trump said about him leading by a lot?
Yeah, I would dispute that, I would say, on various levels. Our forecast had assumed that because we had the Democratic Convention 2 weeks ago, typically a party polls well after its convention, whereas Harris's numbers had been flat to declining. So our model is kind of projecting that forward, saying that Harris might face headwinds going forward. Again, if you had an election today, it would be very close. But, you know, Trump is right in the narrow sense that, you know, Harris has lost that meme-fueled momentum that she had earlier. Maybe she peaked too soon. I mean, again, the debate is yet to come. That's more important. But it hasn't gone quite the way Democrats might have been hoping for, you know, 3 or 4 weeks ago. Mm.
You know, it's so interesting coming out of that convention, because at least on the vibes, it was more, I think if you went just on vibes and people talking about it, yeah, and chattering about it, you would have probably seen more than a moderate bump from that, right?
Look, I like the convention subjectively, but this is kind of why you trust the polls, because sometimes the voters surprise you. I mean, let's remember, Joe Biden was down by 3 or 4 points to Trump at the time he exited the race. You've seen all around the world a backlash to incumbent parties. You saw the Tories in the UK have a really rough election, or Modi in India lost a bunch of seats in their parliament. So Trump is maybe benefiting from being the change candidate in this race. Harris is trying to reclaim that mantle, but she has a problem that she has been the incumbent vice president for 3.5 years now.
Hmm. Okay, so when you're writing about Harris, you say like there are three main factors behind why she's slipping. One is that lower than average bump following the DNC. Another is RFK, the controversial third party candidate, dropping out and endorsing Trump. And the third reason you write and you're specific about this is Pennsylvania. So you're not talking about all swing states. You're saying, look, it's Pennsylvania. What's going on there?
Yeah, look, in our model, Pennsylvania has about a 40% chance of being what we call the tipping state, meaning the state that determines who gets the vital 270th electoral vote. But Pennsylvania has a lot of working class voters that may you know, have more appeal to Donald Trump. He won it in 2016, obviously. Keep in mind that Joe Biden was from Pennsylvania, so might have a little bit of a home state advantage that Harris lacks. And also, she bypassed the very popular governor of Pennsylvania, Josh Shapiro, for Tim Walz, who I think has been a good candidate. But if you're playing the percentages, then you probably want to go with the state that has more electoral votes and more oomph in the Electoral College.
Hmm. There are always swing states, Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania, forgetting a couple. But besides Pennsylvania, what are the states you're watching now with about 2 months left till Election Day?
Yeah, there's kind of two paths. There's this Midwestern path, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Michigan, all the states that are kind of in the Canadian circumference, actually. Then there's the Sunbelt path. So Georgia is a state where Harris polls have been pretty good lately, Arizona, North Carolina, Nevada. Some combination of those seven. And what our model does is try to work through all the different permutations and combinations. But basically, those seven states are the only ones that are likely to matter.
Let's talk about polling, because you said a couple of minutes ago people should trust the polls. And oh boy, Nate, you know, a lot of people are very skeptical. The polls get it wrong sometimes. They get it right sometimes. You've been working on political opinion polling for years, pretty much living and breathing it. So let's go back to 2016, just to remind people, polling came under fire after Hillary Clinton, you know, was expected to win. She did win the popular vote. Many polls had predicted that. But the fact that Trump won a convincing Electoral College victory put that sort of like, I don't like polling, I don't trust polls, doubt in the reputations of many polling firms, including the one that you founded, 538. Since then, has your opinion on opinion polls changed? And if so, how?
Well, if you looked at our forecast, we don't conduct polls. And now I'm at Silver Bulletin on Substack, but we don't conduct polls. What we do is build models that tell you basically how accurate are the polls really? Not what the polls claim, but how accurate are they really? And the answer is maybe not as accurate as people might assume. If you have a candidate up 3 points in the polls, let's say Harris has a great debate on Election Day, she's leading in all these swing states by 3 points, that's not a safe lead. 4 or 5 points is not quite a safe lead either. And so understanding that when you're trying to survey people and they don't answer their phones routinely, and the people who do answer polls may be voters who are more enthusiastic, that you absolutely want to treat them with caution. But remember, the error can go in either direction. In 2022, in some of the key Senate races, Democrats did better than their polls. So, you know, mentally add a 4-point margin of error to any poll you look at in either direction.
Who does polling matter to most? I mean, is it the electorate? Does it influence them? Is it the politicians who then carve out policy and try and twist and turn to get their numbers up? Like, how do you like look at polling when you look at the landscape?
I mean, the conceit of polling going back to the early days of the newspaper era is that you want to give the common person a voice. It's easy for elites like me. Like I said, I really liked Kamala Harris's convention speech, but I'm not a typical American voter, maybe didn't play as well with the average person in Wisconsin or whatnot. So polling plays, I think, an important role in an electoral democracy. But sure, yeah, look, it can change how the candidates behave. One criticism of Harris is that she has been a little bit too poll-driven at times. In 2019 and 2020, trying to win a Democratic primary, she moved pretty far to her left. Now, she has tried to tack back to the center, but you know, voters do have memories. They can watch clips of her from 4 years ago and might have some skepticism of that.
Right. When you're being critical of Kamala Harris, or if that's what you're being in terms of polling, I just want to tell listeners that you tweeted, I think it was this morning, that you're going to vote for Kamala Harris. So just to put that out there as well. Might have been last night. I can't remember. So let's talk about the election. Again, we're, you know, November 5th. So what are we? September 8th, just shy of under 2 months. Like the one in 2016, Nate Silver, it is being framed as a fight between America's establishment and non-establishment groups or ways of thinking. Let's bring your book into this, because you rethink that framing. And I want to talk about two terms that you talk about in your book. You divide the groups into what you call the village and the river. So let's start with the village. What is the village?
So the village is kind of the establishment. It's publications like the New York Times or the Ivy League universities, you know, usually to the northeastern United States, and it's politically progressive. Most people in the village, in fact, overwhelming numbers vote for Democrats, and they tend to be about, you know, they're a little bit more to the left. They tend to be more concerned about the good of the collective rather than the individual, but they also tend to be pretty risk averse. They don't want to buck the trends too much.
You sort of gave broad classes, but of demographics, who's in it? But who are some of the people? Like, if you said village, Nate Silver, give me a name of who's in the village, who would come to mind?
I mean, you know, think of any, I don't know how much your listeners listen to the New York Times, but any New York Times columnist, you know, Thomas Friedman or someone like that is probably in the village, or the presidents of Harvard University who were under scrutiny in Congress last month. Those are typical villagers, I'd say.
Okay. And then let's talk about the river. What's the river?
So the river is a slightly more loosely defined term, but it's the world of people who engage in calculated risk-taking. So think about poker, although poker is a relatively small world, but also things like Silicon Valley or Wall Street, certainly venture capital, areas like that. These are people who are taking risks, like I said, but they're also extremely competitive. So they might be numbers-driven and analytical, but they really want to win. That can make them contrarian, sometimes to the point of being annoying. But in the capitalist economy, that's a skill set in tech and finance that's rewarded quite a bit now.
Okay, name drop some names in the river.
Elon Musk is one name. He's not as disciplined as some people in the river might be, or Peter Thiel, Marc Andreessen, you know, Sam Altman. AI is an important part of this, too. It's kind of the leading technological growth driver in Silicon Valley right now. You probably wouldn't know some of the poker players that I like, but definitely, you know, venture capital is kind of leading the charge from the river these days.
Okay, so are these two groups in opposition to one another?
Increasingly so. I mean, people in the river, in the poker world, for example, they used to say, oh, I'm apolitical, I don't like politics so much. But you've seen, obviously, people like Elon take more of a Republican or really right-wing turn in some ways. It's not everybody in the community. I mean, you know, they're mostly college-educated people, and in the U.S., college-educated voters mostly vote for Democrats. But you know, look, they are upset about the culture wars. They're upset about things like the Federal Trade Commission and antitrust lawsuits and rulings against these big tech corporations. So, you know, it's both cultural and strategic why they're increasingly a rival with the village.
And you recently wrote about how Harris's rise is an example of the village making a comeback.
Yeah, look, I think they made a smart decision to replace Harris with Biden. I mean, if she's in more or less a toss-up race, maybe it tilts slightly toward Trump, but Biden was way behind Trump, and maybe more importantly, didn't really seem to have the goods to fight back. It's as though you had a quarterback on a football team and the quarterback was injured. You know, Biden, in my opinion, and in the opinion more importantly, of about 80% of voters in polls, was thought to be too old. And remember, he wanted to be president for another 4 years. So that was a smart move, but it's still hard to win elections, any election in the U.S., especially when your party has advantage. It's as though you gave the other team 3 points for free based on the way the map is configured. That's a challenge to overcome.
You're listening to The Sunday Magazine on CBC Radio. I'm Pia Chattopadhyay, and this morning I'm speaking to American statistician, writer, and poker player Nate Silver about politics and gambling and about his new book. Nate, let's talk about your book. It's about risk-taking. So how does risk play into what these two groups, the village and the river, are trying to achieve?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think that society, or at least the U.S., is becoming more bifurcated between people who are very risk-loving and people who are very risk-averse. And what, you know, what kind of made this clear for me is COVID, and you see how differently red states and blue states behave, how some people, you know, are happy or not happy, but will stay in their homes for a year and a half at a time, and some people totally ignore the pandemic entirely. I think society needs people that push the boundaries and push us forward, and they also need people to rein in excess risk, to make sure that, for example, if you have Wall Street making bets that taxpayers wind up paying for or bailing out, that's not something we want exactly. Things like artificial intelligence, even people in Silicon Valley think this presents both opportunities and risks. So I'm trying to have a more of an adult conversation about risk and try to have a meeting of the minds somewhere.
Yeah, so out of sort of these, you know, white collar elite kind of groups or demographics, I just want to talk about regular people and risks, because you talk about going to Vegas, I think during the pandemic, yes, you open your book during the pandemic, you go to this, it wasn't Vegas, pardon me, it was down in Florida, I think, right?
Florida.
And you're there and you're finding kind of that people are willing to take risks, and then there's others who are more risk averse. So how are you sort of seeing that play amongst the American population, these ideas of risk being risk averse, especially, you know, after COVID, after the pandemic at least?
Yeah, I mean, if you can imagine that scene, it's April 2021, you know, schools are still closed in much of the northeastern United States, and there are record numbers of people at a poker tournament in Florida. There's a mask mandate, but I will tell you, it was not being particularly strictly enforced. Yeah, what I worry about is that, because both these groups, the village and the river, are the 1%, and the other 98% of people are kind of downstream of their decisions, and I worry about that in both directions. You know, I think the evidence is that things like school closures, for example, under COVID would have failed the cost benefit test, were unnecessarily, although understandably, risk averse. But at the same time, you know, people who are working on AI, artificial intelligence models, will say, hey, there's a chance that these things get really smart and they're not aligned with human values. It could be very bad for society. I'm not sure they should have the right to take that risk on everybody else's behalf, which is why I think we need smart regulation. I worry that, like, you know, it's a story of the 1% making decisions more for the 99%.
Okay, let's get back to politics. One risk that presidential campaigns need to take is picking a VP candidate. And it's interesting because I think, again, a lot of people, when Kamala Harris picked Tim Walz, were like, that's a risky choice. Like, maybe Shapiro would have been the safer choice. But you've said that you believe Harris's choice of Tim Walz was risk averse. How so?
Yeah, look, at the time, she was riding a wave of momentum. She had just consolidated support from her party very quickly. And there were people in the Democratic Party who thought that Shapiro was too much of a centrist, for example, or maybe had, you know, too much ego, I suppose, is some of the backstory. But I, you know, I think she was maybe not looking far ahead enough to the fact that inevitably her momentum would abate sooner or later. And it's really nice to have a popular governor of a guy who's has a proven track record in a purple state, and more importantly, in a state where those electoral votes in Pennsylvania, 18, are just quite important. When you run the numbers, then those 18 votes make the difference quite often.
Mm-hmm. What do you think of Trump's pick for VP J.D. Vance in terms of looking it through the prism that you're looking it through?
Yeah, in a weird way, I think Trump made kind of a similar mistake, where he made that choice after the assassination attempt, when Joe Biden was still the candidate, when he was way ahead in polls, and he said, yeah, I don't need to win over swing voters. I'm going to win this election no matter what. And so let's just have a guy who's younger and will cement the MAGA legacy, Make America Great Again legacy, going forward. Vance is one of the most unpopular VP picks in history. And I think Trump should also have played more to the center with a Nikki Haley or somebody that gives a shout out to the more moderate elements of the GOP base.
Hmm. I want to bring up one more poker term because you apply it to politics. It's called the tilt. What's tilt?
Tilt is when you're behaving emotionally. It can happen because you're on a losing streak, although just as often when you're on a winning streak, you think that you're God's gift to poker and can't possibly lose.
Okay, and you have said that Trump has been on tilt. Am I using that? On tilt? Is that correct? On tilt since the attempted assassination of him. So how are you seeing him being on tilt, and what is he doing to regain these losses?
Yeah, when Harris became the nominee, clearly Trump was not prepared for that, which is kind of a bad excuse. I mean, you know, Democrats are not the same type of cult of personality around Biden that Republicans are around Trump. And they made, like I said, what I think was a rational choice to switch horses. But he was talking a lot about Kamala Harris's race, or saying that her crowds were inflated by AI, when there are better lines of attack. I mean, the fact is that she ran pretty far to her left as a Democratic primary candidate in 2019, 2020. The fact is that voters are still upset about the economy. Inflation is mostly behind the U.S. public, but prices are still 20% higher than they were when Joe Biden took office. You know, I think now he's regained his footing a little bit, but we'll see. I mean, keep in mind that Trump has historically lost 5 of his 6 general election debates, according to polling afterward. The exception, of course, was the Biden debate in the summer. But he is not a particularly strong debater, and he can let himself, maybe his tilt, his emotional issues get in the way of being a more effective communicator.
Thank you for bringing up debates. When you sort of said what you just said, how much is kind of riding on each candidate's performance? Maybe not as much on Trump, but what about Harris on how she does?
Yeah, look, she has to re. I mean, she had one good theme, the whole meme theme. I don't know how much you all follow American politics, but the kind of brat summer, I think, was a nice way to introduce herself to the American public. But she clearly needs to have a second gear. I mean, she's been criticized, I think, reasonably for not offering a lot of policy specifics. Not that a debate involving Donald Trump is necessarily going to be all that substantive. But telling the American people, what does she stand for? Is it a more centrist vision, or is a more progressive one like she showed in 2020? But there are issues like abortion. In her convention speech, she barely talked about abortion. That's an issue where Democrats have a winning hand. The decision to overturn Roe versus Wade cost Republicans in the midterms in 2022 and is still perhaps Trump's biggest liability.
Just to mention, Charlie XCX has declared brat summer over. She doesn't mean that in a political way. She means that in terms of anyway, if you don't know what I'm talking about, go look it up. You're a gambling man, Nate Silver. So come November 5th, who do you think is going to win?
Well, look, this is why we put probabilities on things. Our forecast lately has been about 60-40 for Trump over Harris. But people should keep in mind that, you know, 40% chances happen all the time. A baseball player with a 40% batting average is, you know, the best hitter ever, basically.
Good to talk to you. We'll keep an eye on your work leading up to November 5th. Thanks a lot, Nate. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much.
Nate Silver is an American statistician, political writer, and poker player. His new book is called On the Edge, The Art of Risking Everything. I'm Pia Chattopadhyay. This is the Sunday Magazine on CBC Radio and streaming live on the CBC News app. Okay, now as I do once every month here on the radio, I take a deep breath. I take more deep breaths than that, but this is a special kind of deep breath. As I fling my hosting hat all the way to Edmonton and I leap into the Puzzle Dome, yep, we're back with an all-new round of That's Puzzling.
Supposing you find the answer to who did he do the things to do? The puzzle is still as a puzzle to you. It's what is it that has to be done as a puzzle and song.
Those sounds mean it's time for me to take on one of my CBC colleagues and a super smart listener of the Sunday Magazine in a series of word challenges. Overseeing our game once again is Mr. Alberta, the guy who devises our puzzles, Peter Brown. Here we go, Pete, our third season of everyone's favorite game.
Everyone's favorite Sunday morning monthly radio game on the Sunday Magazine. Easily. Easily. So, Pia, how are you feeling? The first season, I don't have to remind you, you ran off 3 wins in a row. Last year, you were, and I say this as a compliment, the Saskatchewan Rough Riders. I'm not winning now, but I'll win next season. It's next season. How are you?
I'm great. I haven't been keeping score. Pete, listen, consistency and Chattopadhyay both begin with the letter C. So I've hit consistency last season, right?
Oh, absolutely.
I guess the thing that is sort of ongoing for me is that I'm always daunted by my opponents, whether they're ace broadcasters or ace Sunday Magazine listeners. Like, you know, I'm like, how smart will they really be? But I have to say, knowing who at least one of my opponents is today, Peter, has kept me up countless nights. Never before, grandiose statement being made here, never before have I been so daunted entering the That's Puzzling Ring.
And so the expectation management game begins. Pia, let me just say, we want you to have a chance here. We would never, never put you up against someone who ran up a 24-game win streak on Jeopardy. We would, however, have you compete with someone who won 23 Jeopardy games in a row. They are the new host of the CBC's book show, Bookends. Yes, it's the Mateo Roach. Hello, Mateo Roach.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me. I have to do some expectations management of my own. I've been on a bit of a games losing streak lately, so I'm hoping to redeem myself today.
Wait, what kind of games?
Settlers of Catan, oh, Great American Mail Race. I have not been doing well.
Mm-hmm. Now, Mateo, we do know that you're Jeopardy smart, but are you Wordle smart? Are you connections? Do you play those puzzles and how do you do with them?
I'm on NYT Games. It's my like going to bed thing. I wait until midnight and then I do all the games as soon as they become available and then I go to sleep. It's a nice kind of little wind down. My mom and I send the Wordle back and forth every day. And I would say we're pretty even. I take it pretty seriously. I get upset when I lose.
Wait, what is your like normally are you like getting it in three?
I would say 3 to 4.
Yeah,
three
I'm to four. 4 to 5 and I'm an early morning Wordle player. Mm,
yeah.
Yeah, I'm in the Midnight 01 Wordle Club as well. Now, you had success under pressure. You're on Jeopardy. Do you have a ritual or mantra before you compete?
I was a big, like, superstitious Hail Mary sayer, reciter on the Jeopardy stage. Yeah. I went to Catholic high school and there was a big portrait of the Virgin Mary at the front of our study hall where I wrote all my exams. And so I have this association of like, that is who's going to help you in times of academic strife. So that's what I was doing before Jeopardy a lot. Did not do that today. I do have a rosary on, so we'll see if that helps.
Did you wear that rosary just for this reason? You're gaming today?
You know what? We'll say that. Okay. Yeah.
So you have all the forces against you, Pia, is what we're saying.
I've got my Hindu gods and goddesses backing me up.
Oh, that's true. Outnumbered. and you're also up against our third player who won their spot in our listener challenge. We asked you to invent a new word to describe that September feeling when school and work and busy schedules are all back in full swing, but your brain is stuck in summer mode. And our winning word is...
Falstalgia.
Falstalgia. That is our winning listener, Caroline Connolly, somewhere in the prairies of southern Alberta. Hello, Caroline.
Good morning.
Where in the scenic southern Alberta prairies are you exactly?
Well, I am located about 1 hour and 20 minutes southeast of Calgary, Alberta, just north of a famous little town called Vulcan. Mm. You might have heard of it.
You would find people wearing Star Trek pins all over the place.
You would find a little prairie town that doubles as a Star Trek amusement park.
I have one question for you, Caroline. You're in the Calgary band The Love Bullies, great name. Is there a Love Bullies song or lyric that springs to mind as you are about to face these two formidable opponents?
Oh, gosh. And I have to say, with Matea here, I am shaking in my boots. I seriously am going to admit that. We have a song. What springs to mind is a song called Sayonara, and it references wordplay. So it goes, we had a thing. It was so cool. You had to put on a sweater. Someone caught, now turned to naught with the switch of a letter.
Oh, that's great. On that note, we are ready to go. Caroline, Matea, Pia, let's play That's Puzzling. For our first challenge, we are going to stick our toes in the shallow end and play a quick round of our game, Plus One. This version is shorter and faster and easier. Today, I'm going to give each player two letters, the letter I and the letter N, and I'm going to ask you to add one letter to IN to make a new word. So if I said I'm looking for a word that means garbage receptacle, the answer would be bin. You take the I in the N, you add a B at the front, you've got bin. The added letter could go at the beginning, in the middle, or at the end. Because this is comparatively easy, you have 5 seconds to answer. That's
a lifetime in radio has 5 seconds, but not a lifetime in gaming.
So if you hear this sound, your time is up. These are worth 1 point. Pia, you sound so enthusiastic.
You know what you can do at 5 seconds on the radio?
What's that?
I'll tell you. I'm going to time it. Pia Chattopadhyay, CBC News, Toronto. Okay, that's actually only three, so five seems like epically long.
You could do Pia Chattopadhyay, CBC News, Toronto. I nailed it. That's 5 seconds. All right, Pia.
Okay, here we go. I-N-N.
This is in. Yes, you're starting with I-N-N. You're taking those two letters, adding another letter anywhere in the word to make a word that means noise.
Sin. Gin. Oh, my God. Win.
Wow.
Matea's looking at me like, you should just see them. Like, oh, God. Oh,
your answer
so
was
bad.
Din, Pia.
Oh, so bad.
Maybe this is harder than I thought. Let's find out. Caroline, take I and N, add one letter to make a word that means a colored liquid for writing or tattooing.
Come on!
Ink.
That is correct. The official subtitle of today's game is Come On! So we have a point for Caroline and already the righteous indignation of Pia. Matea, take I and N, add a letter to get a molecule that has gained or lost an electron.
Ion?
Wow. That was by far the hardest and quickest.
That was not the hardest. Din. Din is not a common word. Ink, ion, daily usage.
So, at the moment, Caroline has one, Matea has one, and angry, angry Pia has 0 points. For our next round, we are going to play my favorite game, Potato Potato. I'm going to give you two words and ask you to tell me which other word means both of those things and has two different pronunciations. So, if I ask you for a kind of fish and a kind of guitar, the answer would be bass and bass. They're the same on paper, B-A-S-S, but they're pronounced differently and they have different meanings. I will offer each question to one player. If the first person misses, the others will get a chance to steal. There are hints available. I encourage you to take them if you're stuck. These are worth 2 points. Let's play Potato Potato. Matea, you are up first. I am looking for a word that means both talk and opposite. Talk and opposite.
Talk and opposite. This is hard. This is much harder than the first round.
It's supposed to be.
Yeah. I don't want to take the hint because it feels like cheating somehow.
Oh, no. And I'll be like, I'll take the hint.
I guess I'll take the hint. You did say to take it.
Yeah, you can either take a hint pertaining to the talk part of it or the opposite part of it. Which one do you want?
I would say talk.
Okay. It's a verb, as in chat.
That's actually not that helpful. I was hoping it was going to be something about the kind of, I don't know. I was assuming it was a verb. It didn't even occur to me that it might be like a talk. Talk and opposite, counter, recount, gab, opposite, against, across from.
Gonna have to close it down, Matea.
No, I think it's over. I think it's over for me. I don't know it.
Caroline, it's your turn to, you have first opportunity to steal. Do you have it?
I'm with Matea. I'm at a loss here. Surprise, surprise.
Pia, you let out a big sigh. Do you know it or was that tactical?
No, okay, wait. Talk as in a verb and opposite. Opposite. What is opposite? Black and white. Opposite. Talk, chat, chitty chat, gab. Nope.
Is not the correct answer. All right. The answer is converse and converse.
Oh, of course.
Those were exactly the reaction I was hoping for. Converse is talk and opposite is the converse. So we're still on 1 point for Caroline, 1 for Matea, none for Pia. Caroline, it's your turn. We are looking for a word that means blend and a piece of farm equipment.
I should know this. Piece of farm equipment. I'm combine.
And what's the word for blend?
Combine.
Yes.
Combine and combine.
Well done, Caroline. Sorry, Pia from Saskatoon. You probably would have got that one.
We don't have combines in Saskatoon. We do. Like at the tractor store. Peter, you're from Saskatoon. So I don't want the rest of Canada who like has a stereotypical image, many people, of Saskatchewan to like get confused. Like Saskatoon is a large city comparatively to other large cities, but it is the center of the universe in Saskatchewan. Sorry, Regina.
Pia, no one is accusing you of having harvested wheat. I'm just saying people in Saskatchewan generally know what a combine is.
Uh-huh. Do you know what a Quonset is? I know you do, Peter, but throwing that out there. People in Saskatchewan also know what a Quonset is.
Yeah.
Matea?
I have one in my property.
I can't say this is something I'm familiar with.
Oh, wow. Quonset is like a building in on a farm that is like a semicircle, like a dome.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. What do we use that for, Caroline?
Well,
barn dances.
It comes from an Algonquin word, because we actually just looked this up because I am a little bit word nerdy. And we were like, where does that word come from? We have one that's 115 feet long on our acreage. You put your big things in there. You put your combines in there.
Mm-hmm. Mm. You also have stag and doe dances and gatherings in there.
And you have your, your Friday nighters, I suppose. Ours has a dirt floor, so you didn't want to do too much two-stepping in there.
This has been a Prairie Heritage Moment. All right, over to Pia. Pia, yes. We're looking for a word that means now and also means display.
Display, now, pronto. Display, show, now. Immediate. I'm going to take a hint, Peter.
Okay, which one?
Because I'm panicking and therefore hint. Okay, which one? Now or display? I think I'm going to take now, but I think that's a wrong call, but I'm going to go with now.
It means in the here and now.
Well, that's what now means.
Yeah. The blank moment.
Immediate?
Am I allowed to?
No, you got to wait, Carol. No, wait.
Okay, wait.
Easy there, Quonset.
Oh, God. Oh. Yeah, I don't know. Right now. Oh, God, I'm really terrible. No, I don't know. It's not there.
Matea gets first chance to steal. Matea, do you know?
Okay, I took my time. I think I have it. Is it present and present?
Yes, it is. Present and present.
Finally, some redemption, Matea, for me today. Ugh.
After two rounds, Caroline is at three, Matea is at three, and Pia is ideally positioned for the comeback of the century, has not scored yet. For our final round today, we're going to stick with potato, potato. Once again, I will give you two words and ask you to tell me which other word means both those things and has two different pronunciations. Pia, you get first crack at this. We're looking for a word that means take turns and stand in.
Stand in?
Yeah.
Take turns and stand in. One, a single word.
Yes.
Oh, God. Squirrel. Sorry, distracted. oh, boy. Take turns. I'm going to take a clue or a hint or the answer, whichever one you want to give me. Yep.
I'll give you a hint for take turns. You and someone else go back and forth taking turns.
Switch. Flip. Oh God, you should see the control room. Boy, they're just like, I know this answer.
They've seen the answer, so that gives them a minor
Take
advantage.
Take turns. One, three, five, seven. What are those called? Odd numbers. I know that, but like when you take turns, switch.
Yeah, you're onto something.
Oh God. Okay, wait, stand in. If someone's standing, they're filling in, they're a substitute.
Yep, you're on the right path.
Substitute. Substitute. So what am I doing here now with substitute? I'm adding a letter?
No.
What am I doing?
Game. You're looking for a word that means take turns, and you're looking, and the same words pronounced differently means stand in. So your stand in is your what?
My substitute. Fill in my supply. I don't know. I don't know. Blah.
Caroline, do you have an idea?
Oh gosh, I'm running out of ink in my pen. I'm kind of a double switch, substitute, stand in. I was on a body double thing, or like a double up or doubling.
It's that kind of word.
Trying to draw on my...
You're in the right neighborhood, as was Pia. It's just thinking of the exact thing. Caroline, any idea?
No, I'm gonna pass the buck to Matea. I'm putting all my eggs in the basket.
Clearly, the time I had to stew over this over the summer is really paying off. Matea, do you have it?
I have had the benefit of having more time to think about it, but I've been sitting here looking at Pia like I'm a cat about to pounce on a toy mouse.
I have been like averting my eyes from Matea because
they
had it straight off the jump.
Yeah, no, and of course I got the one I did not know, but alternate and alternate.
That's right. Take turns, go back and forth is to alternate, and your stand-in is your alternate. So here's where we are. Matea has five. Caroline has three. Pia, yet to get on the board. It is possible for Caroline to still win. Pia is hoping for a tiebreak.
I didn't make Final Jeopardy.
You did not.
I can't even go
final.
All in. Yeah.
No. Caroline, we're looking for a word that means either insincere expression or make a difference. Insincere expression or make a difference. The first one's a noun. The second one is a verb.
Oh, noun, verb. Insincere expression, a noun. Insincere expression. Make a difference. I wish I could claim that, you know, I had to get up in a different time zone or something.
I'm just telling you, Caroline, I'm looking across the table at Matea, and their pen is moving fast on that page.
Yeah, it's moving fast and with a whole lot of nothing. So don't get too concerned about me.
they're just pretending to write.
I'm just trying to do psychological warfare on PI, I think.
I'm lost, man. I'm out.
I'm across the country and it's working on me. Make a difference. Change.
Another word that means that. I would say the hint that you want is probably for make a difference.
The hint that I would like is for make a difference,
okay.
Please.
As in your actions blank the outcome.
Oh, this is a hard one.
It is a hard one.
Influence?
That's what it means. Yep.
Influence. Synonyms for influence. Influence. Consequence.
Give you a few influence. More seconds, Caroline.
I don't know. This is awful.
All right.
This is awful. I'm sorry.
Don't be sorry. I think these are quite hard. Let's go now. The order that we've drawn up, Matea gets first crack at this, can put the win away right now if they have it.
Okay.
Matea?
I feel pretty good about this. Okay. This is a demonically hard question.
Okay, wait.
Though.
If this was Final Jeopardy, and say you had, Caroline had 9,999 on her pile, and you had 9,999, how much would you be wagering right now?
All of it.
Oh, wow. Yeah. She's asked Matea.
Yeah.
Going for
all of it. Because the last thing you would ever want to do is lose on a question you know.
Right.
Because you didn't believe in yourself. That would be like the just worst, I think, like psychological and emotional.
What about if you weren't 100% certain? How much would you go in for?
Well, you don't know what the question is before you wager, right?
Yeah.
So you're never 100% certain,
yeah.
Right? You're working totally in the dark. And so you have to just like trust and believe that you're gonna know it. Which is very scary, but that's part of what makes it an exciting television show. anyway, I would totally not have gotten there without the hint, but I feel pretty good. Is it affect and effect?
Yes, it is. So affect means to make a difference, and an insincere expression is your affect, like a false display of emotion. Mm-hmm. So
that is
both fiendish and evil, and Pia hasn't even named it yet, and I'm hoping that she will say words that are usable on air.
Just if you can say something nice, shh, say nothing.
So, Matea may be going for a record here, currently on 7 points. Caroline has 3. Pia is playing for the joy of the game. Matea, I'm looking for a word that means both predict and a task or enterprise. Predict and a task or enterprise.
Okay. Predict. I have an idea, but those are not two different pronunciations. I was like, I think that this works. No.
They have 7 words already written down. And nice penmanship.
Oh, thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay, predict. Like, I have a word in mind that I think means both of these things, but I don't think there's two different pronunciations of it. So I think I'm going to take a hint and see if I can come up with something else.
Predict as in an election desk predicts a winner.
Okay, yeah, so I'm definitely wrong. I would say forecast for an election desk, but that's not a task or venture enterprise.
No.
If
you're stuck, try the one you think it might be but isn't.
So I was thinking, yeah, I'm going to guess because that's like what you should do in this sort of situation. I think I would say venture I would use for both predict and enterprise, but that does not, you don't say it two different ways, I don't
think.
No,
that's, you're right on both counts. That is just about the right answer, but you are right in that it's not right. So we're going to go to Pia. I'm looking for a word that means predict or a task or enterprise. Fill in the blank. our election desk is blanking a majority government.
Predicting, forecasting, calling. That's, I don't know.
Caroline, what do you think it is?
I think it's project and project.
That is correct.
The CBC News election desk projects.
Projects. Yes. Predict is project. A task or enterprise is a project. Our final score is Matea has 7. Caroline has 5. Pia, we got this one out of the way. We'll refresh. We'll reset for next month.
You know what? I am just still in summer mode. That's what I'm telling myself.
Yes.
Just like, whoo, water off my back under the hot sun on a beach. Yeah.
This is a warm-up game for you. Mm-hmm. You got 10 rounds of this. You're great.
Great.
Matea, thank you so much for playing. Tell us about Bookends for 5 points.
Yeah, absolutely. So Bookends is my new author interview show. It's going to be airing on CBC Radio and also available on all your podcasting platforms. I'm super excited to talk to some of the hottest names in literature about big ideas, their work, what it means to live in the world. I'm really excited about the interviews we've done so far, and I can't believe still that I get to work here. It feels fake and like a dream.
Me neither. And been here all these years, Matea. Welcome aboard to the Good Ship Mothership. When's your show on?
It is on Sundays at 1 p.m. Our first episode airs
today.
Oh, yeah, today. Oh my God. Sunday, September 8th, 1 p.m.
Yeah,
Don't miss it.
Yeah, but here's your inauguration to CBC land. 1 p.m., 1:30 in Newfoundland and parts of Labrador.
That's important. We always want to respect our Newfoundland listeners.
Caroline, thank you so much for playing. Live long and prosper.
Thank you so much, Peter. Thank you, everybody.
Thanks, Caroline.
Pia, only onward and upward from here.
Only onward and upward. And yeah, good to hear from you again. I've missed you this summer.
I like how you sort of. 60% sound like you meant that. That is mm-hmm. great.
Mm-hmm. And you know what that is? Affected.
That was your affect. Your affect was pleasantry. We've all learned something here today. And Matea, you are yet again a champion. Thanks a lot, and we look forward to hearing the new show.
Thanks so much for having me. This was so much fun.
And that is, for the first time this season, That's Puzzling.
Thank you, everyone. We will be back in October with a new round of That's Puzzling. Oh, send me all the good vibes and maybe some brain cells as well. Hopefully I can do better. If you would like to throw your hat into the ring for October, we invite you to take on our listener challenge. And this one picks up on the theme of the word affect. So here's the situation. It's Thanksgiving dinner. One of your relatives says something you're dying to respond to, but for the sake of keeping the family peace, you can't or don't say anything. What is the word for that moment? Email your made-up word to sunday@cbc.ca. Put That's Puzzling in the subject line, and please include your phone number. You have until the end of next Sunday, which is September 15th, to submit your made-up word. The winner will play in October and win a fantastic prize, which is a Sunday Magazine coffee mug or notebook. And after my chat with Roland Allen earlier this morning, I know which one I would choose. And with that, we've come to the end of another round of the Sunday Magazine. Our producers are Levi Garber, Brianna Goss, Andrea Huang, Pete Mitten, Aronde Williams, and Lou Joe. We had additional help from audio technician Juliana Romanek. Our senior producer is Howard Goldenthal. Our executive producer is Brian Colton. I'm Pia Chattopadhyay. Thank you so very much for lending us your ear. Till next Sunday.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.